Jimmy Muyaha is leading the conversation all across South Africa right now. Stay tuned to SAFM.
Thank you so much to Greg for that news update. There'll be more news with Greg at 7 o'clock. We kick off the first month, or the first day rather, of the month of October with yet another weird law from around the world. We are nearing the end of our weird law series. We've found a lot of them, and we've often found commonalities in the fact that a lot of them seem to originate from the United States. This one, no different, from the state of Michigan. Michigan has a series of blue laws in place that are laws that are usually put in effect on Sundays, and this one is particularly interesting. It is illegal to buy, sell, or trade automobiles on Sundays due to one of these long-standing blue laws that they've had in place. It was aimed at encouraging rest and religious observance when it was initially enacted, and it seems as though there are still some blue laws that remain in place in the state of Michigan. You're tuned into the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb, and on the show today we're going to be taking a look at Capitec results. We're going to be speaking to the company's new CEO, Graham Lee, around the interim performance of the business for the first 6 months of the new financial year. We're also going to have a conversation with a property developer for the Port of Gauteng, taking a look at exactly that, the Port of Gauteng draft white paper that's been put together and what that could potentially look like if we are to get that come through. Then we're going to take a look at the implications of a US government shutdown on the AGOA agreement and how it has affected that. And then, because it is Wednesday, we've got an executive lounge conversation. We're going to be chatting to the Vice Chancellor and Principal of the Vol University of Technology, that is Professor Kehlani Ndlovu. We're going to get to know him a little bit better beyond what he does running the university. So that's what's coming up on the show today.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
As always, we kick off the show with a sense of how the markets have been moving throughout the day. I'm joined on the line by senior market analyst at XNest, Terence Hove, to take a look at market movements and see what to make of them. Terence, always lovely having you on the show. Lovely to catch up. A good day for local markets. Chinese markets closed for National Day. That didn't seem to deter some of the Asian markets, but by and large, the focus being on South African markets. New all-time highs on the JSE, new all-time highs on the top 40. There seems to be a lot of momentum behind those resource stocks.
Yeah, good evening, Jimmy. Great to be on the show, as always. And I think you've summed it up very well in terms of how October started, the last quarter started for South Africa. Things are looking bright, things are looking up. But more so if we look at how the asset classes have been forming across the board from the equities, you've mentioned the JSE, and we look at even on the currency side, how the South African rand has been very resilient in terms of its performance. I think that's speaking to that attractive investor sentiment that we're seeing towards South Africa as an emerging market. And again, you know, that's also flowing through into the various asset classes. And I think the outlook as well for South Africa, there are quite a number of factors that are playing in South Africa's favor as well as an investment destination. And we're seeing that playing out quite considerably, you know, through the rand and the all-time highs, as you've mentioned.
Terence, I'll come back to the rand in a second. I have been keeping an eye on this US shutdown, as I imagine you have, and for the bulk of it, we haven't really seen too much of a market implication on that. But I did see something interesting that came up a little earlier today that suggests that because the shutdown is now in effect, it means that, amongst other things, we might not have an NFP reading on Friday, because that data comes out of a government organization. And if that's shut down, then we might not have jobs data this week. This could be the first time this year. First time since 2018, actually, I think.
Yeah, I think it speaks to the political standoff as it's dragging on. This has always long been a play between the parties. But for such an important economic event such as U.S. non-farm payroll, and for what it means for the U.S. and for what it means for the broader global markets in general, I think they would look to at least publishing those results for sure, because that could have quite a considerable ripple effect, especially as markets are pricing in a possible further cut from the U.S. Fed. If there's delays from that data, how do you then price in the other economic events that will be following U.S. non-farm payroll? Because as you know, non-farm payroll usually comes at beginning of the month, then followed with the other key economic data such as the U.S. CPI, and by the end of that particular month, you've got the U.S. PCE data, and all of these go into forecasting what the possible interest rate path will be and what the Fed might or might not do leading up to a particular meeting. So there's a lot at play other than just the data announcement. It's as I mentioned, it's a key economic event, and I think that they would look to publish those results or data in the midst of all of this political standoff that's going on. If it does happen, I think we will see a lot of volatility coming in the market. Again, that will be priced in, of course, that uncertainty. We're seeing that playing out in the price of gold. But I think it will be better to trade the fact because there's a lot at play for them not to have that data published out.
And as you say, as you mentioned gold, Terence, I'm looking at the gold price at the moment, and I see we are all but $130 away from $4,000 of fine ounce. Did you ever think we'd get to this point?
Jimmy, I think it was sometime last year we spoke about 3,000. And at that point, 3,000 seemed a bit far off, not impossible. But the factors at that time, were not really as supportive. But as the year went into the latter part, as we've gone into 2025, I mean, the narrative has changed considerably. Now we're talking about 4,000. And given the economic backdrop, and a lot of the uncertainty that's driving gold to these levels. For example, we mentioned the U.S. non-farm payroll being published or not being published as a result of that political standoff. A lot of it has also been driven around the tariff announcements affecting various global economies, in particular trade with the U.S. We've seen a lot of geopolitical risks still being priced in the market and still out there in the headlines when they come out, how that drives prices considerably. Even though there's been some peace talks in some regions, but still there's not been concrete peace, if we can call it that, in terms of that uncertainty coming out of the market. So, yeah, 4,000, and we're in October at the moment, so we could finish the year higher than 4,000 as the current trend is going. And it's been a very strong uptrend from the price of gold. And that's been on the up since about towards the end of August. And it's been, yes, as I mentioned, quite a strong uptrend from gold.
Terence, you mentioned the performance of the Rand, and I want to take a look at that in a bit more detail. We're currently at 17 Rand 20 at the moment, but we did see 17 Rand 12 since, and that, I think the last time we saw that, if I'm not mistaken, was September of last year. So again, in territory we haven't been in at all this year, considering we come off of 19 Rand 93 against the US dollar. Clearly, at the moment, there is a lot that the Rand is doing right, and perhaps there's a bit of help from some of the things that the dollar isn't doing as right. Where do we see this going? Do we see this? I mean, this has been quite a support level at this point in this range. Do we have enough momentum to break 17 Rand?
I think we do, Jimmy, and I think it's also taking advantage of the dollar wobble, as you've mentioned. You make mention of last year, September. We came off about 18 to the dollar, beginning of September, strong rally to 17. Today, we're seeing that similar play in as far as September is concerned. If we look at 2023, a little bit back, The rand came off from a high of about 1930 to rally towards about 1865 thereabout. So I think that September a rally in the rand that we're seeing has played out and is still playing out at the moment. There's still quite a number of positive factors for the South African rand, with positive data coming out for South Africa in the manufacturer PMI data, better than expected. And you mentioned the equity markets as well, you know, that rally. And we shouldn't forget as well that on the macroeconomic front, the South African Reserve Bank, kept interest rates on hold compared to the US Fed, which cut interest rates. So that also plays well for the South African market as investors look to those attractive higher yields. And given that microeconomic stability, it even makes it even more attractive. So I think there's a lot playing in favor of the South African rand at the moment for that momentum to continue.
Terence, as we go into the last quarter of the year, where do you think the momentum sits in the markets? We've seen the resource counters run quite a bit. We're seeing some rand strength. We're seeing some dollar weakness. We're seeing the gold price doing amazing things. Where do you kind of shift your focus towards the tail end of the year?
I think at the moment, as you mentioned, with the resource sector, given the levels that we're seeing at the moment, the historic high levels, as we touched on earlier, I think this remains a key space to watch, especially with those prices being driven higher. I think the retail space as well, that's always an interesting part of the economy to observe going into this last part of the year, because the consumer has been constrained if we look at the past year or two. Now we've got a bit of relief. Are we going to see an uptick, you know, as we come to those key purchase days, your Black Fridays? Are we going to see an increase in volume in terms of purchases? So I think that also becomes a good space to watch as we are going into the last months of this year, to also have a gauge of where the consumer is at the moment.
Lots to look forward to as we head into the final quarter of 2025, but still markets are pursuing the stronger gold price, and we'll see how that continues to affect some of the other markets that we're looking at. For now, we'll leave this conversation on that note. Thanks so much to Terence for those insights and for the time. Terence Hove, Senior Market Analyst at XNess.
When you're growing your money, you need to make the right choices. That's why at Standard Bank Private, we offer the best of everything. Our offshore investments are award-winning. We'll give you the best forex rates around. As SA's biggest home loan provider, we offer unmatched expertise, and you'll have access to the best financial planners and bankers. So why not visit standardbank.co.za to join Africa's best private bank today? Standard Bank is an authorized FSP and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
There are plenty of people who want to invest in the stock market but don't, because they believe it's only for the rich. Well, now you can buy some of the best performing investments in the world, even if all you have is 1 rand. That's right, 1 rand. I'm talking to Connie Bloom, CEO of a digital assets trading platform built on the blockchain, and the company's called Mesh Trade, to talk about what the future of investing looks like. And as we find out, it's definitely not just for the rich. Don't forget, join me, Kieran Ryan, weekly on the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast. Listen on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify.
MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
A rather interesting white paper was released yesterday for the Department of Transport, Transnet, and the provincial governments relating to our logistics and freight corridors. We are referring to the Port of Gauteng white paper here, and we're going to be taking a look at what this is all about with the developer of the Port of Gauteng, Francois Nortier. Joins me on the line now to take a look at this and other developments. Francois, thanks so much for taking the time. Lovely to have you on the show. Tell us about the Port of Gauteng, for those that haven't heard about what has been proposed here. What is this?
Good evening, Jimmy, and good evening to your listeners. It's an inland port, a dry port. It's situated between the N3 highway as you come into Gauteng, just before the urban edge, or just in the urban edge. The one boundary is the N3. The other boundary is the Durban-Gauteng railway line. The provincial road runs through the middle of it. The petrol pipe from Heidelberg to Alberton goes there, and the dark fiber backbone, It is 1,400 hectares of land that's been earmarked in terms of the Ekurhuleni Metropolitan Spatial Development Framework for Logistics and Light Industrial. So we want to build two terminals there, one for containers and one for car. And then there's land for all kinds of logistics, truck stops, massive warehouses, smaller warehouses, distribution centers. And we want to put one or two data centers there to take advantage of all the warehouse roofs that will be filled with solar. So there'll be massive excess of solar that can give green energy.
Francois, why do we need an inland port? South Africa has a couple of ports. We've got a port in Durban. We've got a port in Cape Town. What is the value of an inland port such as this?
It creates a place where the goods can be unpacked, assembled, and better organized to go into the rest of Africa. Because you've got a port in Durban, and then you've got 550 kilometers to the port of Gauteng, and then the road split. So it's an assembly point and a distribution point where things can get together, that it can go down the N3 in a more coordinated way and get to the port of Gauteng. That can come five different shipments, and then it can get you there. And one truck can go to Rustenburg, one truck can go to Middelburg, one truck can go to Pietersburg. So it's a point where the... It's a junction where the goods get sorted before it goes in all kinds of difference. It leads to better logistics. And you need a terminal somewhere in Gauteng to bring in all the imported cars. You need a terminal to bring the containers. They can't go to 10 different directions by rail.
Francois, let's take a look at how this project would then be rolled out. I mean, you've touched on the fact that it involves a couple of provincial governments, it involves a couple of different entities throughout this. Are we looking at something that forms part? I see in the white paper there are mentions of the National Development Plan. How would this project be executed? Would it be one of those build, operate, and transfer models? What have we got proposed here?
Okay, let's just distinguish between the Port of Gauteng and then the white paper. The Port of Gauteng is what I described to you, but we also issued a white paper how to improve the corridor, the freight corridor between Durban and Gauteng. Because the better that corridor works and the better the port in Durban works, the better the port in Gauteng will work. So the white paper deals with the corridor, which is KwaZulu-Natal, Free State, a little bit in Mpumalanga and Gauteng. That's why that is addressed to those entities. So the white paper is a document that we issued to show how that corridor logistics costs can be reduced on that corridor, how goods can move to rail, and that corridor is more open for cars, that the tourism industry in KwaZulu-Natal is not choked off by the N3 just being a truck highway. So you must please distinguish between the Port of Gauteng as a property development and then the white paper that the Port of Gauteng issued, how to deal with the freight corridor, which the NDP says it's the most important freight corridor in South Africa and must be by 2030 the example of all other freight corridors in South Africa. So we've shown how it can be an example by moving goods cheaper, faster, and more reliable.
So the Port of Gauteng will exist regardless of the outcome of this white paper. It is a development that is in effect already, and it is something that we are already looking to leverage off of. Is that correct, Francois?
That's correct, but it'll work much better if the corridor works better.
As do all things, I suppose. So, Francois, when we look at the logistics infrastructure, South Africa, you alluded to it from a freight rail perspective, we have got a freight rail infrastructure set up in South Africa, but it would benefit from greater efficiencies. How does the port of Gauteng then enhance the road side of it? Because for a lot of the manufacturers, a lot of what has to move on rail in South Africa, when a Transnet goes through the challenges it has gone through over the last couple of years, it becomes very difficult to move everything, and there's a greater reliance placed on the road side of it. How does a port of Gauteng development solve for that?
We're supporting the PBS initiative, the performance-based system for trucks. It's been piloted in South Africa by Paul Nordigan, that used to be with the CSIR. And the government didn't do much on it for the last 5 years, so that's why we're pushing. And we believe it's just been accepted by the government that they can go further with this PBS study. These PBS study allow longer trucks, heavier trucks, and they design that they do less damage than lighter trucks. They drive safer. So it's a very long story, but if your readers can go and read up about PBS trucks and Paul Nordigan. In Australia, there's now 28,000 of these trucks. And we are canvassing for that and wanting to promote that these PBS trucks are allowed from Port of Durban to the Port of Gauteng.
Francois, can the Port of Gauteng be used to perhaps improve our logistics infrastructure into the continent? You touched on this to say that there's a more than a 500 kilometer distance, I think you mentioned, between where things land in Durban and where we export or where we transport into the African continent. If we then have an inland port, is this a blueprint that can be used to sort of set up other inland ports throughout the African continent that we can then link all together? I'm thinking about things like the Africa Free Continental Trade Agreement, and these ports seem like they'd be useful towards things like that.
Yes, then the idea and Rail Runner, one of our partners that was at the conference with the launch yesterday, they will run the trains. And the reason why they want ports everywhere, one at Komati, one at Messina, one in the Winelands in the Cape, then they will run trains from inland port to inland port. So it's definitely the case.
Francois, how expensive is it to set up one of these ports? As a developer, you would have gone through, I imagine, a lot of things around feasibility and land and everything in between. But this surely can't be a cheap exercise, even though it is a necessary one, it sounds.
No, it's not a cheap exercise, but at the moment it's just the land cost. I've bought quite a few large parcels of the 1,400 hectares, and it's expensive with rates and taxes and security. But luckily, this piece of land was a neglected part of the world that didn't have high value, so our base price wasn't expensive. And there is another 100 hectares, 100 properties that make up the rest of the 1,100 hectares that are for sale. They're also not at high prices. So it's a matter of buying it at the right price and then doing the land conversion. And then the big money comes when you build the building. But very few of these things will be built on spec. If there's a demand for a container terminal and there's an operator, or what might be the operator might buy the land then get the finance to build the terminal and then operate the terminal and the railway line. So the big money will still be spent. The 50 billion that's going to be spent there, the 99.9% of that is still to come.
Francois, would you say that every other inland port would probably be around the same in terms of costing, if we are to look at what it is that you've spoken about? Because some of the inputs that you've put into the port of Gauteng, we are really looking at things around cleaner energy, infrastructure that accommodates more than one use case. And so that seems like a logical kind of expansion plan. Is this model kind of perhaps what we should be looking at, even at our existing ports?
I can't talk about the existing ports. That's a different, a seaport is a different thing. But it's exactly the same model at all inland ports, I would think, all over the world. And there is quite a few planned inland ports in South Africa. So I assume that they all follow the same principle. It's a land development, property development principle that you have to follow.
some interesting solutions to South Africa's unique logistical challenges, an inland port, or the first of many inland ports that we could potentially be seeing, the port of Gauteng. We'll see how this development continues to unfold. Thank you so much, Francois, for giving us some insights around how this would work and around just the value it would create for the South African ecosystem. We'll leave the conversation on that note. Francois Nokia, developer at the Port of Gauteng, taking us through the use case for an inland port.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Capitec Bank Holdings Limited, a bank that briefly dethroned the First Rand Bank as the most valuable bank in South Africa by market capitalization, released their 6 months update for the 6 months ended 31 August 2025. And we're going to be taking a look at these numbers with the new CEO of the business, Graham Lee. He joins me on the line now to take a look at the numbers and see what we make of them. Graham, lovely to have you on the show. Welcome to the SAFM Market Update. And first of all, congratulations are in order. You and I haven't had the privilege of having this conversation since you have assumed your role. And I suppose this is a good time to start having these conversations. A strong set of numbers for the first 6 months of the new financial year. Operating profits up, headline earnings up. By all accounts, the bank continues to grow, continues the momentum it has had pretty much since it started. How do you reflect on the first 6 months and on your change of role?
Hi, Jimmy. Thank you very much for having me on your show. It's an absolute pleasure to join you today. So from the perspective of the results, I think it's true to say that it is a fantastic story for a new CEO to be given the privilege to share with the market. So it's a very great start for me. We have continued to focus on our fundamentals and the strategy that we've laid down over the course of the last couple of years. And that's returning good results. That focus on clients and our client needs continues to yield benefits in terms of growth in our client numbers, particularly the faster growth in some segments like the youth. And that returns the results that you see today.
Graham, how does a business like Capitec continue to grow with the momentum it has? There was a time where, and I think I remember it was probably around the pandemic, where Capitec had more than a third, or the first time that Capitec crossed the threshold of having more than a third of South Africa's population bank with you. I thought, okay, surely at some point the business is going to start growing at perhaps a slower pace. That doesn't seem to be the case. What's the secret to the business at the moment?
There's no secret, Jimmy. Our model is actually a very simple one. We start with focusing on our clients and our client needs, and we make that an important part of our culture. Every mechanism we have points all of our employees to putting the client first. And then we design around the client and those client needs. Secondly, we drive innovation, but not innovation of any kind and for any without meaning, purposeful innovation for clients. And we make sure that our organization is structured around delivering change for those clients. And then we encourage our people to be bold, to make decisions, to be guided by our principles, but make the right decisions for our clients. And then we design our business for scale. We're a volume business and we seek scale in order to be able to create economies and to then pass those economies back to our clients. And in order to be able to gather data and to then better design our processes, our engagements, offers for our clients based on that data. And that then creates a virtuous cycle, passing back both the economies and the personalized offers to the clients, attracts more clients, which in turn then builds you up the further scale.
Graham, let's take a look at some of the numbers over the six-month period. I saw that net impairments increased a little over 5% from a business perspective. Is there anything to be worried about there from that, or is that just a function of some of the operating conditions that you find yourself in at the moment?
Yeah, no, it's nothing to be worried about at all. I think if you take a key metric like the credit loss ratio, and you split it out in personal banking, that credit loss ratio has actually come down. So we've improved that metric. It's a healthy book that's become less risky. If you look at business bank, you need to look at business bank two different components. One is the intuitive business, which is largely secured. The credit loss ratio on that has remained flat. And then there's the new business, largely scored, more unsecured, that the business bank is starting to do. And that comes at a higher credit loss ratio similar to the personal bank. But we know that, we plan for it, and we price for it. So that small uptick is nothing to be concerned about. That is execution of our business plan. What really drives the entire group CLR up is the inclusion of Avafin, and particularly the fact that we're comparing 6 months this year to a comparative period of 4 months last year.
Graham, you touched on the business side of Capitec being a little different to the personal banking side of it. How is that business banking division coming along? I know there were a couple of bolt-on acquisitions to kind of establish quite a good foothold in the market around that. The acquisition of Mercantile's really working out for the business from that perspective. How is the management team seeing the business banking offering, and how are you feeling about it for the next 6 months?
We are very proud and excited of our business bank offering. What was Mercantile has now been fully rebranded as Capitec Business, quite a while ago now. And we have put in place all of the platforms and technology, as well as the human capability to be able to scale that business now. So we are starting to go out into the market with a lot more vigor, and we're doing so both digitally through new innovations like our scored overdraft available on the app, which reaches a large amount of clients, but also with a more traditional approach of using people to understand our businesses and give them the respect that they deserve. And that means having boots on the ground. So we have a number of innovations to be where our businesses are. At business talk events around the country, with teams going not just to the big towns, but also all of the small towns around the country, and being available where our businesses need us.
A bank then continues to innovate for its clients and continues to ensure that it offers the best in service to the market. A bank that has started off the financial year on strong footing looks to have a strong second half of the year and will certainly catch up at the end of that second half of the year. For now, we'll leave this conversation on that note. Thank you so much to Graham for those insights and for the time. Graham Lee, Chief Executive Officer at Capitec Bank Holdings, joining us to take a look at the first 6 months of their new financial year and what potentially lies ahead for the business going forward.
There are plenty of people who want to invest in the stock market but don't, because they believe it's only for the rich. Well, now you can buy some of the best performing investments in the world, even if all you have is 1 rand. That's right, 1 rand. I'm talking to Connie Bloom, CEO of a digital assets trading platform built on the blockchain, and the company's called Mesh Trade, to talk about what the future of investing looks like. And as we find out, it's definitely not just for the rich. Don't forget, join me, Kieran Ryan, weekly on the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast. Listen on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify.
MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
In the early hours of the morning in South Africa, which would have been midnight in the United States, it was made official that the United States government has shut down. The United States Congress was unable to pass legislation around the spending of the U.S. government, and as a result, the U.S. government is technically in shutdown at the moment. Now, that has some serious implications on the U.S. markets. That has some serious implications on the country of the United States, but it also has implications on South Africa and other countries. For those that are wondering what I'm referring to, the AGOA agreement officially expired on the 30th of September 2025. Now, whilst Washington had previously expressed interest in renewing the AGOA agreement for at least another year, we saw that our own minister, Minister Parks Dowd, also expressed that that was looking positive. The technical implications of a U.S. government shutdown are that we do not have AGOA in place at the moment. We're going to be taking a look at this and trying to make sense of it with the director and chief economist at Econometrics, Dr. Azar Jamin. He joins me on the line now to see what we make of these developments. Dr. Jamin, always lovely having a conversation with you, always lovely catching up. Thanks so much for taking the time. We've heard that the South African government is barely holding together, but when looking at where the GNU stands today and where Washington stands today, one might argue at least there is a government in effect. What do you make of the recent developments out of the United States?
Well, yes. You know, theoretically, one shouldn't be too worried about the shutdown in the US government right now, because we've had numerous such shutdowns over the recent years that have lasted a day or two, and then eventually some agreement is reached between the Republicans and the Democrats on a way forward that can actually accept a compromise that allows the government to resume. But on this occasion, you know, one can't be so sure, because there is such acrimony and the divide is so huge between the Trump administration and the Democrats that one wonders whether there will be a short-term solution. In particular, the Democrats are using this as a vehicle through which to actually stand up to the Trump administration in a manner that they've been unable to do for in recent months, because of the dominance through which and the manner and of the executive order processes that have gone through the hands of Donald Trump in signing off these orders, and the Democrats have been left out in the cold. So this is one way in which they can get their own back on Trump and make life as difficult as possible for him, so that I think there is a chance that we could see the shutdown lasting longer than has been the case whenever there's been a shutdown in recent times. And one shouldn't forget that the reason for the shutdown is basically the U.S. runs out of money. Its public debt is rising all the time because it's running the government's running a big budget deficit. And if anything, it's getting even bigger now as a result of the introduction of the so-called Big Beautiful Bill by the Republicans a few weeks ago, that promises an even bigger expansion of the budget deficit.
The last shutdown that we had in the United States was in the first term of President Donald Trump back in 2018. I believe that shutdown lasted 34 days, the longest in American history. Can we take a look at the implications of such a lengthy shutdown, perhaps, on relationships and on the current geopolitical climate? I mean, we know that things like tariffs are new to the second term, and things like executive orders that you've alluded to as well are also something that we didn't see in the first presidential term of Trump in such severity. How does this current shutdown then affect the ongoing decisions that need to be made, like the decision around whether to renew AGOA?
You're quite right in highlighting this as a dilemma in some respects, but we've got to bear in mind that the tariff orders have the increase in tariffs introduced by the United States are already in place. So theoretically, they will continue beyond the 30th of September unless anything contrary is passed through Congress. And AGOA can't actually be officially extended unless it gets the go-ahead from Congress. But with the American government shut down, you can't get a go-ahead for that to happen. But, you know, there is a bigger complication in this than people realize. To the extent that the United States has already imposed tariffs on South Africa and a number of other African countries under executive orders, and those continue now and remain in place beyond the 30th of September. AGOA, on the other hand, is a vehicle through which the United States reduces tariffs to zero for manufactured goods from various African countries. Now, if AGOA cannot be extended in any way, or if AGOA has basically been superseded by the big tariffs that have been introduced, and unless you have Congress actually deciding to the contrary, I think what happens is that all these African countries, including the likes of Lesotho with 50% tariffs on clothing exports to the United States, that's going to remain in place until such time as Congress decides otherwise. And one doesn't know how to marry the concept of AGOA, which is zero tariffs, with the concept of tariffs actually being imposed under the Liberation Day so-called Liberation Day regime that was introduced by the Trump administration. So it's a really confusing picture at this stage. All I'm suggesting is that for the present, those 30% tariffs on our automotive products, various agricultural products, iron and steel and the like, they remain in place, unfortunately.
What does this mean for the rest of the world? Do we have other lingering conversations or potentially decisions that could be impacted by this extended government shutdown? I'm thinking about something like the upcoming G20 summit that takes place in November. Now, it's unlikely that we will have a shutdown that leads all the way through to that point. Would there be any implications on such an event if we were to have a shutdown extend that long?
I think there would be some ramifications. I'm not quite sure where the boundaries of the shutdown actually exist. It's effectively a shutdown in the functioning of government, central government itself. It doesn't mean that the whole private sector shuts down at all. And the G20 is made up of many different threads, including government direct involvement, in which case there would be an impact. But there are many other interest groups also involved, and they are not shutting down. So it's, again, a very complex, a very uncertain environment that we're heading for in this regard. And theoretically, I would imagine South Africa might stand to carry on being the having the chairmanship of the G20 insofar as some of those government functions are concerned.
Some interesting potential consequences of a U.S. government shutdown and how it potentially affects global markets, but more specifically, how it affects South Africa and our ongoing strained relations with the United States that we're trying to improve. We'll leave the conversation on that note. Thanks so much to Dr. Jameen for that, for those insights. That was Dr. Azar Jameen, Director and Chief Economist at Econometrics, joining us to take a look at the impact of a U.S. government shutdown on AGOA.
There are plenty of people who want to invest in the stock market but don't because they believe it's only for the rich. Well, now you can buy some of the best performing investments in the world even if all you have is 1 rand. That's right, 1 rand. I'm talking to Connie Bloom, CEO of a digital assets trading platform built on the blockchain, and the company's called Mesh Trade, to talk about what the future of investing looks like. And as we find out, it's definitely not just for the rich. Don't forget, join me, Kieran Ryan, weekly on the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast. Listen on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify.
MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
Looking for smart ways to invest? Investec Structured Products' latest investment could give you 125% participation in world equity markets with a maximum return of 50% in US dollar terms and 100% capital protection. Join an exclusive live webinar on Wednesday, the 8th of October at 10 a.m. with James Cook, Investec Structured Product Specialist, to find out more. Visit moneyweb.co.za to register.
You are listening to Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
It's Executive Lounge time on a Wednesday. We get to speak to leading executives from around the world and in South Africa and get to know them a little bit better beyond their day-to-day responsibilities. This week's executive is from the educational sector, and the executive is currently the Vice Chancellor and Principal at the Vol University of Technology. Of course, that is Professor Stephen Ketland-Lovu. He joins me on the line now to get to know him a little bit better beyond his daily responsibilities. Prof. Ndlovu, thanks so much for taking the time. Lovely to have you on the show. How does one become a Vice Chancellor?
Thank you very much, Jimmy, for inviting me to your show and your listeners. Well, for starters, it's a journey. I think, let me put it that way. It's a journey because you consider it an epitome of a position at a university, and therefore you need to have at least the academic background that is required, normally a PhD with some serious publication background, engagements in different sectors, but also having had a substantial experience in the higher education sector. Just to give you an example, I probably have been a lecturer before, and I have served as a director, especially in the Office of the Vice Chancellor, as a strategic advisor to the Vice Chancellor. I've been at DVC 3 times at different universities, and now, of course, Vice Chancellor and Principal of VUT. So you do need an element of academic background.
Okay, Prof, so we understand the how. Why?
Well, why one becomes a vice chancellor? Sometimes it's a challenge within the context of wanting to make a contribution and sometimes make a difference in terms of where you see an institution is at the point in time, but also looking at how best you can help navigate its future. And I'm using here the example of VUT because I didn't come through VUT, but I came from UNISA to VUT. And one of the things, probably the history of VUT would tell you, that it has been having challenges in the past in terms of two administrations and so on. So one, sometimes I take a step back and say, using my experience, how do I see myself helping this institution become what it's supposed to be in the context of playing its role in the human resource development of the country.
Mm. Prof, you mentioned that part of the requirements include holding a PhD, and we all know the journey towards that. But it's no secret that once you obtain your first PhD, there's an itch to get a second. Are you aiming to start collecting the PhDs at the moment?
You have to ask yourself, what is it that you learn in a PhD? I'm lucky because my dean, when we started with an honours, Bachelor of Education honours, he made it very clear that he is preparing us to be academics. And at master's level, he will be giving us a platform to practice what we have learned and demonstrate that we are ready to actually be the producers of knowledge at PhD level. And then, of course, PhD. So I don't see any value in having a string of PhDs because it's actually one process that you are learning how to develop new knowledge. Of course, you can then use that framework in any field of study. And that's how I always look at it. So that's why I don't believe that having a number of PhDs would help you in any way. But of course, you can use the skill you learn to do research to actually apply it anywhere.
Prof, what would you say to the students that you lead? You are tasked with, as you alluded to, leading quite a significant number of students in the form of the Vol University of Technology students that you are the custodian of. What would you say to those students about the world in which they live in today and about the South Africa in which they're coming into as they exit Vol University?
They need to value education, but more importantly, to the extent possible, that as young adults, I mean, I always say to myself, we work to influence many of our young adults to be next pioneers, to be leaders, to be entrepreneurs, and, you know, let alone the fact that they will be shaping our future. And I always want them to think like that, to say, I came to university, I'm going out, I'm going to be this leader who will have a significant impact in the lives of South Africans. And I think that's what is important that we need to inculcate. I mean, I'm out here in India, we've been talking about how do we create empathic students who then foster empathic societies. And it starts at the university. And if we lose that opportunity, we're likely not to achieve what we'd like to see in the future.
Prof, the India trip is quite an interesting trip for you. And I imagine there's a lot of learnings around that. Do you think there's value in having global relationships in the world that we live in today, whether it's strategic networks, whether it's just having friends in other countries? Do you think that plays an important role in not only development of individuals, but perhaps even more specifically, development of students?
Look, for starters, both staff and students, I'm just going to talk at both so at least can have the picture in terms of ensuring that we are able to learn from about and about other cultures. This helps us build better human understandings in the world, and that's a critical point. And with that, we hope to have reduced human conflicts that lead to human suffering. I mean, there's a lot going on in the world, both in Africa, the Middle East, and so on. So how do we create human beings that would have that kind of sense of saying, you know, it's better to live together and create a world that all are safe, that all are able to strive in it, and so on. So it is important that we have to look at it in that way. So here we have about institutions from 35 countries, and we had opportunities to exchange ideas on issues of AI, how we ensure our education produces, as I said earlier on, empathic students to support and empower our empathic societies. And I think this is very, very, very important.
Prof, are you enjoying the food in India, or are you missing home food?
Well, I am a cook.
So you take home with you?
a self-made chef. So I always experiment with food. So I don't have a problem eating Indian food. But of course, you have to be careful where you eat. and you have to know what you're eating. Mm. What is it? How it's made? Sometimes when you see something like a very interesting, you need to ask a chef and say, explain to me how you make this. Then you know, oh, okay, these are not ingredients that I may have challenges with, and so on. Yeah. So, but the food is great here, healthy. And so one begins to realize that sometimes it's all about the healthy food we eat that helps us sustain ourselves.
Prof, what's the most regrettable dish you've cooked or have experimented with?
regrettable dish? Hey, regrettable dish. I don't remember a regrettable dish. But I can tell you one of my best recipes that I normally, when I have friends and family, you know, is to have the whole salmon wrap it up and put it in herbs, wrap it up in newspaper, and dampen the newspaper in water, and then put it in a braai stand and braai it, you know, or hot coals. And what happens is then the dampness in the paper protects it from burning, but at the same time creating steam inside, you know. And as the paper burns, your burn becomes your flavor also, in terms of having what you call, you can call smoked salmon without necessarily smoking it.
I suppose along the way, that is part of the learning experience, is sometimes getting it right, sometimes not so much. Prof, do you have any particular sports that you enjoy watching or participating in?
I play golf for two reasons. One is it's one sport that teaches you how to manage time, because it's a very long, it takes a long hours, 5 to 7 hours. And therefore you need to plan, because if you don't plan, you'll never play good golf, because there'll all be disturbances in the process. So that's the one part. But also, it gives you the kind of fitness that you normally don't have, because we spend a lot of time sitting, and therefore we walk 7 to 8 kilometers, you know, per round. So that's a kind of exercise that actually is good about it. Of course, nowadays, as we get older, we start using cuts, and that defeats the purpose.
But it does make it all the more fun, does it not? It does add to a bit of...
Oh, there's a lot of fun. There's a lot of fun. Actually, sometimes you play so bad that then you decide and say, next week I'm coming back here to show the cause that you can do better, you know.
And that's all. And at the end of the day, that's what it is all about, is doing better than what you did yesterday and doing better for tomorrow. Thanks so much, Prof. We'll leave the conversation on that note. That was Professor Kehlani Ndlovu, who is the Vice Chancellor and Principal at Vaal University of Technology, joining us to get a sense of what it is he enjoys doing when he's not safeguarding the futures of South Africa's youth.
SAFM Market Update with Jimmy Muyaha on SAFM.
That's the show for today, folks. If you've missed any of the conversations, of course, they will be made available as a podcast for you to catch up on as we go into the final stretch of the financial year, or at least of the calendar year. The last 3 months are typically quite busy for us, and we're going to be keeping an eye on a couple of things. We're going to be particularly in this week keeping an eye out on what happens on Friday. If we do not get US data in the form of jobs numbers, it is a very real possibility that the government shutdown in the United States will mean that we might not get other data for the rest of the month. Whether or not that will influence some of the market movements and some of the decisions investors might be taking remains to be seen. For now, the South African markets are still riding the wave of positivity. I had a quick look at some of the markets doing well. I think Sibanye might be the best performing share year to date, and the likes of Glencore might be on the worst side of things. But for now, it is coming up to 7 o'clock, which means Greg Kos is standing by to give you the latest round of evening news. He'll be followed by Michael Abramson and the Top Sport team. So from my side, good night.